Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When he was in his late 30s, the Italian poet Dante Alighieri got himself into some serious political trouble and was exiled from his beloved Florence. Fortunately for us, he didn't wallow the way I do, eating gallons of Tillamook coffee almond fudge ice cream and binging nearly prestige TV. Instead, he wrote one of the world's greatest literary works, The Divine Comedy. In this story, Dante, the main character, must pass through the nine circles of hell, climb Mount Purgatory, and ascend to heaven to reach salvation. Along the way, he meets all sorts of characters, including the Roman poet Virgil, various politicians of his time, teachers from his school, and his one true love.
So lifelong practice of poetry, an interest in words and their effect, and intense personal hardship, I think, are all ingredients of this poem. My name is Naseem Chida. I'm a lecturer at Columbia University.
The poem is divided into three main sections. The first is called Inferno, when Dante is in hell. Purgatorio, when Dante is climbing Mount Purgatory. And Paradiso, when Dante is in heaven. Part of what makes the poem so extraordinary and alive is how Dante subverts the expectations of his readers. Expectations about empathy, theology, the afterlife, even down to the language that it's written in. The poem even challenged Professor Chida's own personal expectations.
I wrote my dissertation on Dante's Inferno. I first read the Inferno, or even really heard about the Inferno, as a freshman. So it wasn't part of my family's culture. And I took a year-long course just on the Inferno. And I think the first thing that just mesmerized me was that it felt like a portal. It felt like a gate into another world. And this world that I was seeing just was so at odds with what I expected. Kind of coming into a medieval text, I sort of expected something difficult to read. I expected something austere, doctrinal. And the world it was introducing me to, I believed would be cruel, one-dimensional, not diverse. I had all these expectations. And I found just the opposite of that. And over 3 years, I completed the Divine Comedy, and by the end of it, I think I was completely hooked. I learned not just about how to read and how to a whole new relationship with literature, but also I felt that I got that bug of reading things that are ancient and culturally alien to me. Because it helped me locate the common humanity between the reader and the author. If you only read people who have of the same background, the same century, that interested in the same things, you sometimes miss that, and you can become really sectarian in your reading. But when you sort of discover literature through a Catholic, Florentine, medieval man, you discover really what in you is cultural and is of the present, and what is in fact universal. So when Dante makes me laugh or Dante makes me cry, I feel like in that moment I find my own humanity.
Welcome to Writ Large, a podcast about how books change the world. I'm Zachary Davis. In each episode, I talk with one of the world's leading scholars about one book that changed the course of history. For this episode, I sat down with Professor Naseem Chida to discuss Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy. So let's learn about Dante, the man, and his times. What was the world that he was born into like, and how did he become the person who could write something this deep and brilliant?
I think the main aspects of his time is the overall kind of long conflict between papacy and empire that had been going on hundreds of years before he was born and that continued after he died. So there's this sense of chaos, really, who's in charge.
Dante was born sometime around 1265. But hundreds of years earlier, beginning in the late Middle Ages, a political rivalry arose in northern Italy over who would rule the northern Italian city-states. The rivalry was between the authority of the Pope and the Holy Roman Empire. Before there was the Holy Roman Empire, it was called the Kingdom of the Franks, and it was ruled by Charlemagne. He fought his way across Western Europe, conquering lands and spreading Christianity. The empire was huge. It encompassed much of modern-day France, Belgium, Netherlands, parts of Germany, and parts of northern Italy. The Pope also ruled over land in northern Italy, called the Papal States. In the year 800, Charlemagne proposed a deal to Pope Leo III. Charlemagne wanted his power to be formally acknowledged by the Pope, and he wanted to be crowned Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. In return, he offered Pope Leo III protection from invading tribes. Leo III agreed, and on Christmas Day in the year 800, Charlemagne was crowned Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Although this crowning was just a formal recognition and didn't give Charlemagne any new powers, it did make ultimate political authority a little unclear. Was the Pope in charge, or was Charlemagne? As the years went on, the lack of clarity to that answer raised tensions from a simmer to a boil. Groups emerged on both sides of the issue. The Italian political party that supported the Pope's political authority was known as the Guelphs, and the party that supported the Empire's was known as the Ghibellines. The two parties struggled for power for roughly 300 years.
It was an extremely divided time, especially in Florence.
Dante was born in Florence, right in the middle of the struggle.
He wasn't a noble, but he married well, and he seems to have had a lot of friends that came from the high nobility and that were in politics.
Although many of Dante's friends were into politics, he had a different aspiration: to write.
He started writing poetry at a very young age. So the poems that he wrote when he was 18, and it was the fashionable thing to do to write this poetry. We have rhymed letters between him and some of his contemporaries again in his 20s. And he continued actually to write poetry throughout his life. So it's not something that he abandoned. It's something he constantly went back to. So I think that he's a craftsman. He was interested in words and literature and forms and formats and different audiences. He also wrote a book of literary theory, The Vulgar Eloquence, which is really about literature and language.
Dante especially loved poetry. He cherished many of the poets of the classical world, including Ovid, Cicero, and Virgil. He particularly admired the Bolognese poet Guido Guinizelli. Early on, Dante began to establish a name for himself as a talented poet in a new style of love poetry called the Dolce Stile Novo.
And then he went into politics, and for a brief amount of time, he was one of the priors of Florence, so I would say a member of government with quite a lot of influence and power, but not more than others. And politics was a very dangerous game. It involved making a lot of enemies and getting embroiled in very violent conflict.
When Dante was in his early 20s, the Guelphs defeated the Ghibellines and gained control of Florence and the surrounding area. This meant that the Pope once again held political power in the region.
What was the church's role in public life and private life?
The church is a center of power and a form of organization. It's many, many things, but it's really an organ of power, a force to be reckoned with. And religious life permeated life. So this was a time of monasticism, of friars spread out in society. Some people argue that Dante himself may have been a kind of lay Franciscan at some point. public festivals and public events were permeated with Christian rituals. So there was an institutional and social aspect to it. There was a cultural aspect to it. And then when we talk about worldviews, there's something that is radically different about Dante's worldview. And that is, in his Christian worldview, in his Catholic worldview, God is really at the center of the universe. Everything flows from and goes back to God. So there's a kind of centered point, which really is radically different from our concept of the universe, and just we're on this planet floating in space and we don't know what's out there. I mean, there's a sense of knowing what's out there and knowing humanity's role and place, both in space and in time. So there was a creation, and then there was, an end time is expected, a judgment day is expected. In fact, on judgment day, which comes up multiple times in the Divine Comedy, people were expected to regain their bodies, the physical bodies. And Dante says, so that mothers and fathers and those that were dear to them could see them and enjoy them, presumably hug them. So there's our sense of our own lifetime, our sense of time, and our sense of our place in the universe was radically different from the way it was today.
Dante had fervent faith in God, but considerably less faith in men. He was critical of the church clergy, especially the rampant nepotism and the buying and selling of religious favors, such as pardons from sin. Dante frequently spoke out against church corruption and abuse, a move that ultimately got him exiled from Florence in 1302.
And then after he was exiled, it's much more difficult to track his movements, because what we have primarily is Boccaccio writing a generation later, and who's known for being quite inventive and having quite the imagination. So I don't know how reliable that is. We have some letters, so we know that he worked professionally as a secretary to some rich families, writing their letters and being in charge of their correspondence.
Following his exile, Dante most likely spent time in Rome and various parts of Tuscany. He began to distance himself from politics, and a few years later, he began work on the Divine Comedy.
What did the writing of it look like? How long did it take?
It's really not entirely clear what his schedule of writing was. We know that people refer to this inferno, or this account of going to hell, before the poem is completed. So there was some kind of circulation as he went along. Some scholars argue that it was written for a very specific audience. I'm not convinced by that, just because of the how eclectic the work is. It seems to have something for everyone, rather than I'm writing for a specific group of people. But people have argued that. Other people say that it was written, on the cuff, like, because there's some sort of, when he talks about political events, sometimes it seems to be that he's writing in the moment or right after the moment. So there's this sense that maybe he was in exile and he was going from place to place, or maybe he found somewhere where there was a good library and then he wrote two or three cantos and then great. And then he was facing other hardships and then got somewhere else and wrote a few more. So there are a lot of questions about how it was really produced, and there is no autographed manuscript. So it was copied, and all we have are copies. And in fact, the title that he gave it was not the Divine Comedy. The word "divine" was added by those who copied it.
So was it originally just called the Comedy?
Yeah. Initially, the earliest manuscript kind of begins, here begins the Comedy of Dante Alighieri, Florentine by birth, but not in his ways.
And what did he mean by comedy?
It goes back to a medieval conception of genre. There was a simple rule: if it ends well, it's a comedy. If it ends badly, it's a tragedy. So given that it ends with a meeting, an encounter with God, it had to be a comedy. So by calling it a comedy, he's kind of reminding the reader and announcing, this will end well. I will get out of hell. I will get past purgatory. And this ends this has kind of a good and mystical ending.
The poem is divided into three main sections, which are structured in canti, or songs. Each one is around 150 to 200 verses long. In total, there are 100 canti in the Divine Comedy.
The first 34 in the Inferno, the second batch is Purgatorio, and the last batch is Paradiso, so hell, purgatory, and heaven. Each text ends with the word stars. There's an effort even in the kind of construction and the almost like the DNA of the text to preserve it entirely. So there are references back and forth throughout the text that suggest that it is divided in three parts, but it was really important to kind of see it as one epic poem.
To the degree possible, could you take us through the broad arc of the story?
I think the first thing to point out is that you have an extremely overdetermined plot. He wakes up or he finds himself in a dark wood. He meets the ghost of Virgil, who says that he has been sent through the will of heaven via Beatrice to help him go through all the circles of hell.
Throughout the poem, Dante follows several guides at different times: Virgil, Beatrice, and Saint Bernard. His first guide is Virgil, who takes him to the gates of hell. In the gates is inscribed, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." Virgil explains to Dante that he will have to pass through the 9 circles of hell. These 9 circles are concentric, each one inside the previous, and they get increasingly more treacherous the closer to the center they are. At the very center, Satan is held in bondage. Each circle of hell contains people who have sinned to various degrees and are eternally suffering as a result.
So, I mean, what else does Inferno have? Is it mostly it going through each circle and seeing who's there until you arrive at Satan?
So first of all, the first circle is limbo, where there are, in fact, no punishments. So people seem to be dressed. They have a kind of bonfire going. Plato and Aristotle and Aeneas, and they're all just hanging out in limbo and in a place that does not seem terrible to be in, beyond the fact that they're cut off from God. He spends some time there with other poets and philosophers, thinkers and scientists, military men and legends and women. So that's the first place where they linger, which is where Virgil is from. So it plays immediately with that sense of guilt and condemnation. You just wonder, how fair is it that Virgil is stuck in hell? You get to the lustful and you think, should I also be fainting of pity for someone who's in hell? And what does that make me? What kind of a reader am I? A reading about a woman who read so badly, I guess, or so wrongly that she ended up in hell. Among the sodomites, he meets his teacher. Whom he meets and shows extreme affection to, mentions how his teacher had a kind paternal image who, from time to time showed him how man makes himself eternal. And the teacher says, "Well, remember me and my book." So this book is now recorded in the Divine Comedy, also eternalized with the man. So these are all examples of kind of how it really pushes that frame and plays with the expectation of just seeing, this is sodomite, let him get a punishment and then I can move on. I think Dante just didn't think that would be that interesting or rewarding for the reader to do.
After Dante and Virgil pass through hell, they have to climb Mount Purgatory. Similar to hell, Mount Purgatory also has levels. Each level is higher up on the mountain than the previous. The higher up they are, the closer they are to heaven and God. There are 7 levels in total, each one loosely tied to the 7 deadly sins. Like in hell, these levels are also full of people who sin to various degrees. In hell, the sinners are punished and tortured. But in purgatory, as you ascend, you atone for these past sins.
So at the bottom, you have the people who were actually excommunicated. So Dante is very clearly saying, you know, the church cannot buy you from heaven. Like, they don't have that power. At best, you'll end up here. So it's just a waiting game. Really, you're saved. And then you kind of progress from there. Hell has an Aristotelian framework. It's not based on seven deadly sins exactly. And it, very clearly, God has read Aristotle in Dante. I mean, there's a scene in Inferno 11 where Virgil, he's asking like, but what about those people? Why are they here and why are those people there? And Virgil says, remember your ethics. So hell has an Aristotelian kind of framework, but purgatory has a more traditional Christian framework where there are various vices and each one is sort of purged in a different way. So the envious, for instance, have their eyelids sewn shut. So it's both painful and it's symbolic, right? They can't see the light of God. They're barred from seeing that light, even though they're in purgatory and they should be able to see it. The prideful carry giant stones on their back, which I always think of as the ego that they're carrying, and that kind of makes them bend down in order to lift the load. And the lovers, who are just the least bad, who are just right by, just before you get to the Garden of Eden. An interesting part here. Among the lovers, you have heterosexual and homosexual lovers. They're both clearly saved together.
Dante and Virgil make their way to the top of Mount Purgatory and reach the highest level, the Garden of Eden.
And then from there, he takes off into the heavens, into space. And then kind of the heavens are divided by planet. So there's the moon and then, you know, the planets, the sun, and eventually reaches the rose where he's just gazing into God's mind.
What happens in Paradiso, in heaven?
So in Paradiso, he stops in various spheres, and so he meets this woman Picarda that he knew in his childhood, who kind of sort of sets the scene for what it means to be blessed. She's kind of in the suburb of heaven, as it were. She's sort of far away from the center. She's the first circle, the closest to the earth, and you slowly get closer and closer to God, but. So you see various souls, you know, sort of in the heaven of the sun, you see all these intellectuals, these theologians. At one point he meets the eagle of divine justice. So all the souls of the just collect in the shape of an eagle. And he gets to ask a question. And this is one of my favorite passages, because the question that he asks is, if a man is born on the banks of the Indus and has never heard of Christ but is a good person, where is the justice that condemns him? Paradiso is a kind of way for Dante himself to wrestle with a lot of theological questions. He also gets tested by saints on his faith. And there's a very scholastic kind of medieval education sort of scene where he's asked, with how many teeth does love bite you, you know, things like that. And then Beatrice actually leaves him in the final cantos, and she's replaced with Saint Bernard. She sort of takes her place in the rose, staring at God. And he kind of finishes the journey with Saint Bernard. And the last time he sees her, she looks at him, and then she looks up at God. And it's a journey towards freedom. You know, it's presented that way. He thanks her at the end. He thanks her using the two instead of the more polite sort of lay form. Like it's an intimate moment. And he acknowledges that she has brought him from bondage into freedom.
How does the text end?
Every text ends with the word stars. And so the final verse of Paradise is that he sees the love that moves the sun and the other stars. So he sees the mind of God. He's able to look into the mind of God, and in a flash, he sees a human form. He sees abstract sort of squarings of the circle, as it were. You know, he sees the impossible, the ineffable, the kind of unspeakable. And that's how it ends. He just sees the love, and presumably the whole universe. So that's the plot. And so it's very hard to inject suspense, right? So if you say from the beginning we have to go through hell, go all the way to Lucifer, and then find our way on, it it very easily becomes repetitive. And so the 100 cantos are, he takes that as a format and then fights against it and brings in all kinds of adventures. It's hard to summarize all of them, but I would say the plot involves feeling extremely ambivalent about what is happening most of the time.
Throughout the Divine Comedy, Dante subverts the expectations of the reader.
So you expect to just maybe have pity or suddenly feel a sense of condemnation for those people in hell. But in fact, encounter after encounter, not all of them, but many of them, including the last big one at the bottom of hell, you're left with a totally different feeling. It brings up situations and stories that test our own sense of morality and reveal who we are by how we react to them.
What do you think motivated him to do something this ambitious?
I think that what motivated him personally was a desire to be immortal, like a desire to propel himself and preserve himself for posterity. When he gets to paradise, when the character Dante gets to paradise and he meets an ancestor to whom he says, if I am a timid friend of the truth, I fear that those who will see our times as ancient will forget about me, that I won't live long in their minds. So he gives us a clear sign that he's interested in speaking directly to posterity and believes that in order to do that, he has to take a certain position vis-a-vis the truth, I would say. I think that that was the deeply motivating thing. It begins in the middle of the journey of his life. That's kind of usually the time when we start seeing the end and wondering what is going to be left. And he's also exiled and at this extremely difficult time of his life. And so it's kind of an instinct to preserve yourself in the face of adversity, I believe is the primary factor.
Not only did Dante make himself immortal, but he also preserved the characters in the poem, specifically Beatrice, who he knew in real life. When Dante was 9 years old, he met a young girl named Beatrice Portinari. He claimed that he fell in love at first sight. But despite his passion, Dante's family arranged for him to marry someone else from a more powerful family. Even though Dante never really got to know Beatrice, or more likely, because he never really got to know Beatrice, his love for her endured throughout his life. In addition to the Divine Comedy, Dante also featured Beatrice in his 1294 work, La Vita Nova, a short text about medieval courtly love.
So Beatrice has died by the time he's writing, but the Vita Nova is about her death, his love for her and her death and what happens afterwards. And I think that it was a way to bring her back and preserve her as well, because he did write about her and present her in a way that you can't really find in contemporary fiction, where the lady never speaks in the text of his time. And here she not only speaks, she saves the hero. She explains why there are dark spots on the moon, and she literally leads the way to God. So there's I think his grief and his relationship to Beatrice as a person and as an idea probably is also part of the reason why he wrote something like this.
At the time, serious Italian texts were written in Latin, but only the educated elite could actually read Latin. Dante decided to write his epic in Italian so more people could read it. Italian was considered a low and vulgar language, and writing a poem with a divine subject matter in Italian was very controversial.
He was very conscious of the value of writing not writing in Latin, for instance, and the way that that might both affect all readers and reach more readers than writing in Latin.
And so it's composed of canti, of these cantos. Did he intend for these to be read out loud? Like, is there an oral quality to them?
There is an oral quality to them. For instance, many passages imitate the sound of the thing that they're describing. So you can hear the sinners scratch themselves because of the use of certain words with R's and T's and Z's. So it was designed to be read out loud or even sung out loud. So there is that aspect to it, but it would be wrong to think that that's what it was designed to do, because he very clearly wanted to be glossed or expected to be glossed, because there are references in it. Even if you're the most erudite reader of the time and you immediately know who all the people are, he refers to things that are internal to the text that just haven't come up yet. I believe it was meant to reach a very wide audience, that there would be people who would kind of enjoy the invectives and enjoy the political satire. I wouldn't call it satire, but the political invectives, but also the sense of adventure and the beauty. And there would be other people who would just sit and pore over it and copy it and count syllables and fill in the blanks. So it's a very interactive text, and it interacts at many different levels with different sorts of people.
What is he saying about the nature of God? What is God for Dante?
For Dante, God is what is essential, and everything else is circumstantial. So it's that which exists without needing anything else to exist prior or before. So it's God is everything, and God is the beginning. But he also has a typical three-part view of God being infinite power in the Father, infinite wisdom in the Son, infinite love in the Holy Spirit. So it's a kind of a God with three components.
So I think the final question about the text itself would be maybe your thoughts about how to think about Beatrice, Beatrice. You know, what's useful to know about this person who seems to be at the center of Dante's life?
Well, we know that she existed. We know that she got married. We know that she died in childbirth in her 20s. And we know that she didn't have enough importance to be recorded by others or to be a player in the life of Florence. She exists through Dante's text, who kind of kept her alive. I think proto-feminist, I mean, in some ways, certainly his contemporaries were absolutely appalled by his use of her in the text. They were appalled that this Florentine woman from, you know, was explaining God and science and theology to Dante. They were appalled that she is up there with Mary and St. Lucy, that she kind of addresses Virgil, that she gets to do all these incredible things. So, you know, it's hard to really give the label, but I think that he was doing something for her that was he was representing women in a way that was totally different from his contemporaries. What may or may not have happened between them is lost, unfortunately, because he tells us so much about her. I mean, in the Vita Nova, he describes first meeting her and then meeting her a second time and then how she died and how he dreamt of her. So he gives us all of this, but I mean, it's all fiction. It's not, I mean, there's no outside the basis for that. There's no other source that confirms any of it. So, and he's such a storyteller and an inventor that it's hard to really say if there was what element of that was real. And she's the agent of his salvation. I think that's really the key. And that is shocking even now. You know, to even now, I mean, if you met someone who said, "Oh, I have a new girlfriend, she's going to be the agent of my salvation," it kind of seems a little bit intense. You know, it seems like that's a bit much to put on one person. I think it's more rewarding to think about his relationship with her and her role in the text, not as one that represents a kind of illicit or not relationship between individuals, but something, she inspired something in him.
So how did his contemporaries react to this text?
The immediate reaction was mixed. There's a part where he puts all the popes in hell, so that couldn't have gone down so well in certain circles. But there's also a story about how Boccaccio would recite certain, wanted to recite the Divine Comedy, so the next generation in Florence, but was sort of booed out of town because there were too many descendants of the families that he puts in hell. So it's very political, and it was, you know, the, if you were responding at the time, it was mentioning a lot of people that people knew in recent history. And people then, after the Divine Comedy, sort of rushed in and spilt a lot of ink trying to defend people that he had put in hell. So there's a lot of kind of defensiveness at the time because of how vividly, because of its all its historicity. The book that was later burnt and got a lot of was censored by the church is not the Divine Comedy, it's the Monarchia, another political book that he wrote. And my advisor was, I think, is the one who speculated one time that in part it's because he includes a lot of classical literature in his text. So Virgil is there as the guide, there's centaurs, there's the Cerberus, there's just all kind of, you know, elements of classical literature which may have convinced his contemporaries, it's a fairy tale. It's not a book of theology, so we don't need to burn him at the stake with this. You know, this is just a fun little thing. So it has an inbuilt defense mechanism in a way. And it lasted for a long time in terms of its authority over readers. It was much later in the Enlightenment, it was cast away with a lot of medieval texts, as part of a rewriting and reconceptualizing of the Middle Ages as a dark time of cruelty and dogmatism and simplicity. And you can just pick up any canto and that proves the opposite. So I think that's a big part of why it was cast aside. But then he was rediscovered in the Romantic period. William Blake kind of did all those illustrations. But throughout that time, I would say he's somebody that really profoundly impacted visual artists, really from, you know, Michelangelo to Dali have all illustrated the Divine Comedy. And I think that that is a big part of his legacy as to, is as a creator of a virtual reality. And I think in part that is why visual artists are so interested in him, because he is a playwright and a VFX master and a director. But I think that the fact that his poem also has all this fun in it, like it has, you know, kind of these moments of suspense and these magical creatures, and it gets very scary at certain points. That sense of, well, I have to entertain the reader and I have to take something that can be used and reused and reformulated in different ways. So you can find basically references to Dante's Inferno in South Park, you know, and it's very easy to lift something and use it as a framework to express something else. Mount Purgatory, the concept of purgatory also we owe in large part to him. Not that purgatory didn't exist as a concept, but it was absolutely not detailed. There was no detail. Nobody bothered to describe purgatory. It just didn't feel interesting. Whereas he kind of really gave it shape and form, to the extent that it then started to be represented and people just assumed, well, this is what the church thinks, but actually this is what Dante thinks, about what purgatory might've looked like. So he has theological ramifications, artistic. So Dante kind of for the lay, readership, like Dante is Christianity, which is strange because he's absolutely, some of the things he says and claims are theologically absurd. For instance, God having read Aristotle, or people are in hell before they've even died. All kinds of things are just not like the popes who are not dead are already expected, which makes no sense, right? Because if you can be saved at the last minute, then you can't be expected in hell. So he's not dogmatic at all. And yet, for many people, the Divine Comedy is their first and greatest encounter with Christianity.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned, the way that a lot of popular Christian understandings of heaven, purgatory, and hell are Dante's invention. And, you know, that's wild, right? I mean, poets are the unacknowledged theologians of the world. That's amazing. And I wonder if church leaders have been at pains to say, no, that's just Dante. That's not what we actually believe.
Well, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because on the other hand, you can read Dante and walk away from that thinking, oh, well, I better be a good Christian, you know, and there's nothing in it that he doesn't admit to breaking these theological rules. Quite the contrary, he presents himself as, he makes a truth claim. I mean, there's nowhere in the comedy where he says, I'm going to make this up. He says the opposite. I woke up in a dark wood and I saw this. And he perpetually underlines, you know, reader, I swear by the notes of this, my comedy, I saw, you know, this thing. So he's kind of claiming, making a truth claim about the work.
Through his poetry, Dante achieved his dream of immortality. The Divine Comedy is a work of surpassing beauty and faith and helped forge our conception of heaven, hell, and purgatory. It continues to be read and beloved by millions. But in addition to immortality, there was another, more immediate reason he may have written the poem.
Some people have argued that he did it in order to find his way back into Florence. You know, he says one day I will go back a poet, and he never did. So maybe there was a sense of hope that by writing something so incredible, or by writing specific things about specific people, he might gain favor and find his way back.
Dante died at the age of 56 and was buried in a tomb in Ravenna, Italy. Florence eventually regretted exiling Dante and made several requests for his remains. They were all refused. In 1829, Florence even built a tomb for Dante, but it has remained empty ever since. In 2008, roughly 700 years after his death, Florence finally officially rescinded his sentence of exile. Even though Dante never made it back to Florence, in some ways, his wish was answered. Writ Large is produced by Jack Pombriant and me, Zachary Davis. Script editing is by Galen Beebe. We get help from Fair Undo. Our theme song is by Ian Koss, and our branding is by Dan Pecci. We're a member of LitHub Radio. Writ Large is a Lyceum original production. You can find us on our website, writlarge.fm. There, you'll find transcripts, links to the books we discussed, and more information about today's guest. Thanks for listening. See you next time.